Welcome back to the Religions of the Ancient Mediterranean podcast. My name is Phil Harland. I'm a prof at York University in Toronto. We're continuing now with the series, The Historical Jesus in Context. The purpose of this series is to investigate what we can know using historical methods only about that peasant Jesus who lived in first century Galilee. One of the main points of this Historical Jesus series as a whole is to say that perhaps the best way to approach understanding the historical Jesus is by looking at him within the context of his contemporaries. We can know more about the context in which Jesus lived than we can know about Jesus himself using historical methods. And once we know about that context, it limits the field of who Jesus could have been, you could say. So there's very limited purposes of this series. You may remember in a previous series, we've looked at the Gospels, which are a main source for the historical Jesus, but we looked at them from a different angle, namely what they're best for, and that is getting a view of how did late first century followers of Jesus interpret the meaning of Jesus? What stories did they tell in order to communicate what they felt the meaning of Jesus was? This series is very different than that previous series, and I would suggest it's important to listen to that other series first, namely the Portraits of Jesus series. This series instead has far more limited scope in its approach. Namely, historical methods are limited in what they can tell us about an obscure first century Jewish peasant from Galilee. And this stems in part from what we investigate in this and the following episode. Namely, the nature of our sources. Our main sources for the study of the historical Jesus are primarily written by people who follow Jesus and who had very particular views of what the meaning of Jesus was. For this reason, they are not very good historical sources for getting the more stripped down view of just the basics of what that peasant Jesus did and said. They provide us, the Gospels do, with all kinds of information about what a late first century follower of Jesus felt was important about Jesus and what the meaning of Jesus was to that particular person in a particular community. In this series, we have a more limited scope and we'll soon see that it's quite difficult to get at the historical Jesus, that figure who lived in the 20s and 30s CE in Galilee. In this episode, we investigate the question of what sources do we have, beginning with external sources. There are very few Greek and Roman sources outside of followers of Jesus that refer to Jesus. Nonetheless, we discuss the importance of these sources and what they can tell us. We then move on to Judean sources, including Josephus and archaeology. Finally, in the following episode, we investigate more fully the nature of the Christian sources and the limited nature of these sources when it comes to trying to do modern history in investigating a figure like the historical Jesus. So I hope you enjoy this episode, and do feel free to browse around on philipharland.com where you can read more on similar subjects. In order to study the historical Jesus, in other words, that peasant Jesus from Nazareth, we need to introduce some things. So today we'll be talking about our main sources for the study of that peasant Jesus. We're going to be looking at Jesus among his contemporaries and in the eyes of his contemporaries.
This is a useful approach to things because we'll soon see there's not much that we can know with a high probability about the historical Jesus. You can know things in different ways, but with historical methods, you can only know things in a certain way. And there are limits to what history can tell us. And in the case of studying a figure like Jesus, history can tell us very little. It tells us important things, but what it tells us is limited. The approach I'm taking is very few of you know historically about the context of Jesus. So from your perspective, a great way of knowing a lot about Jesus is to know a lot about his contemporaries. It doesn't tell you a lot about the details of what Jesus did or said, but it does tell you a lot more than you already know, because it narrows down who Jesus is to know where he's living, to know what his contemporaries are like, and to know what it's like in Galilee and what it's like in Judea, etc. So our approach is going to be quite broad in that way. I find that the most appropriate approach that is actually fits with the nature of our evidence. Because the nature of our evidence, soon you'll see, is such that we can't say much about the historical Jesus, about what he exactly did or did not do, that peasant from Nazareth. Historical method can only say something is highly probable if it's got so many things in place. And those things that need to be in place just aren't there often for the study of Jesus. Let's start by looking at the sources, because it's in the nature of the sources that the problem lies. We do not have the types of sources we would want as historians in order to understand things about that peasant Jesus from Nazareth. Well, we have something, so that's good. But what we've got is not what we would like as historians. Let's talk about some of the sources we have, though. First of all, we have external Greco-Roman sources that refer to Jesus. There are two main passages in two different historians who are not themselves associated with the Jesus movement. In other words, these are non-Christians. There are two main sources that are important for the study of the historical Jesus that are not Christian. All the rest of our sources are by people who follow Jesus. But let's look at these external sources because they're very important. They're very few, but they're very important. And they solidify the most probable thing about Jesus. The thing we can say most securely about Jesus, historically speaking, is that he was executed by crucifixion under the governorship of Pontius Pilate. The most secure thing we as historians can say about Jesus, right there. Tacitus is a Roman historian. Well, in his history of the emperors in the first century, he has a passage that deals with the reign of Nero. Nero is reigning in the 60s CE, and Tacitus is writing about 40 years later. Tacitus looks back, as many upper-class elite Romans, looks back at Nero and doesn't like him. Now that Nero's long dead, many people don't like him. So he goes through a variety of things that Nero did that show how bad an emperor he was. One of the incidents was about a fire in Rome. So Tacitus' interests aren't to talk about Jesus at all, but he ends up having to. There was a fire in Rome. Rumors spread that Nero himself had asked to have the fire set. So he'd set out his cronies to set the fire. Why? Because Nero was soon going to be renovating that part of the city of Rome. And what better way to clear out the place than to burn everything? He needs a scapegoat. Somehow, Nero knows enough, not much, but enough about followers of Jesus that he knows they're disliked by some people. He picks them as the targets and says they set the fire. Round up some Christians in Rome and have a big display showing that they're to blame for the fire. They get brutally slaughtered, the Christians that gather together, so it's terrible for them. In the midst of this, Tacitus had to look into what he could find out about those people that were killed. He's writing history. To some degree, he wants to get details. This is what he ends up knowing. This is a Roman imperial official, similar to Pliny, Roman imperial official. And this is all he finds out about them, at least it's all he tells us he found out about them. So he says this, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace." So he says people label them Christians. So that's an outsider label for Christians to begin with, right? I've already mentioned that to you. And then he says this, and this is the key for the historical Jesus information. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. That sentence there is all that's important for the historical Jesus. Crucifixion was considered the most extreme penalty and was used on only the worst criminals. It was the most humiliating way to die. Often you'd be consumed by dogs and birds after your slow death. And so this was considered the extreme penalty for the most heinous sort of activities, including revolt against Rome. So that's what we've got from Tacitus. So we have sources outside of Christian sources that say that Jesus was executed by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate. That's the most secure thing we know about the peasant Jesus, his death. Before we go from Tacitus, let me read another little passage here in the exact same area. So right after he talks about the leader of the movement having been executed, he says this: "It's a most mischievous superstition." There's that word again. That's what Pliny thought of the Christians, superstition. This is what any upper-class Roman thinks of just about anything other than what they themselves do. "Thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular." That's his view of how people in Rome, besides the Roman elite, do things. But the point is here, his perception is it's a Judean phenomenon. A Judean who was executed under Pontius Pilate, and somehow a following built up. And now they're in Rome. And now Nero has blamed them for the fire because they're perceived in a negative way sometimes by some of the people of Rome. There's a whole lot of other sources that are available that refer to Christians, but none of them are particularly pertinent to the historical Jesus. That Pliny the Younger letter I mentioned, that was also written around the same time Tacitus was writing, 110 CE, deals with Christians that are brought before him. However, Pliny says nothing about the leader of the group besides that that Jesus is honored as a god or whatever he says his impressions are. But he doesn't say anything about the historical Jesus, about the movement or where it came from. Let's move on to Judean and Galilean sources for the historical Jesus. First one was Roman, external Greek and Roman sources. Now we're on to Judean and Galilean sources for the historical Jesus. You've already seen how little we know from the Greco-Roman sources. But it's an important point, the execution of Jesus. Josephus is a Jerusalemite. He's from Jerusalem in Judea. Not only that, but he's from a priestly family. He's from a family that served as priests in the temple in Jerusalem, the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem that you've been learning about in our previous discussion. Josephus lives in a time when the revolt against Rome takes place. He actually ends up becoming a general in the revolt against Rome. That revolt that took place from 66 to 70 and ended with the destruction of the temple in 70 CE. But the point is, at one point he was a Judean fighting against the Romans, leading the fight against the Romans. And at another point, after he was nearly about to be killed by the Romans, he switched sides. So he's viewed as a traitor within some camps, you could imagine. He ends up befriending their emperors themselves. And he moves to Rome. And he's actually given money by other Roman imperial elite, including the emperors, to engage in his historical work. And what does he do? He writes one history about that Judean revolt called the Judean War. And he writes another work called Judean Antiquities. The name gives it away. The whole point is how antique Judean culture is, and therefore how legitimate it is. So although he's considered a traitor in the Judean cause of the revolt, he's obviously a very Judean guy who's still defending Judean culture within the Greco-Roman world. So those are the two main works. There's others, too, that he wrote. Judean War, written in the 70s, late 70s CE, so very soon after the Judean War itself. Judean Antiquities, written probably in the 90s CE, about 20 years later. In Judean Antiquities, there are several passages that pertain to Jesus either directly or indirectly. There's one that I really want to spend some time on, but let me at least mention the others. First of all, we're going to, in the tutorial and also in a later lecture, we're going to deal with the passage about John the Baptist. Very important historically for studying John the Baptist because it's our only source outside of the Gospels for John the Baptist. There's another passage where Josephus refers to James, and it seems to be the same James who's related to Jesus, the brother of Jesus. and he talks about James being killed. He doesn't go overboard with that or describe it in much detail. He refers to him, though, as a respected figure within Jerusalem who ended up being killed by people who were against him. The main passage for us that's significant, though, is the Jesus passage. There's an extremely controversial passage in Jewish antiquities, in Judean antiquities. So in this work, all three of these are in antiquities. The most controversial passage in all of Josephus's writings is precisely this one right here, Antiquities 18, 63 to 64, which is the Jesus passage. The reason it's controversial is because in the form we have it in the Greek manuscript, the critical edition that's developed by scholars, the Greek we have for this passage has things that do not at all sound like Josephus. For example, here's how the passage as we have it goes. I'll sort of skim through some things. At this time there appeared Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one should call him a man. For he was a doer of startling deeds, a teacher of people who received truth with pleasure, and he gained a following both among many Jews and among many of Greek origin. He was the Messiah. And when Pilate, because of an accusation made by the leading men among us, condemned him to the cross, those who had loved him previously did not cease to do so. There is the most important thing for what we've observed so far about what we know most about Jesus. We now have another external source outside of Christianity, if this is reliably by Josephus, which we're arguing is plausible here, another source saying that Jesus was condemned to crucifixion under the rulership of Pilate. So we have multiple attestation of this idea of Jesus, the peasant, having been executed. It then goes on, those who had loved him previously did not cease to do so, for he appeared to them on the third day, living again, just as the divine prophets had spoken of these and countless other wondrous things about him. And until this very day, the tribe of Christians named after him has not died out. So, what John Meyer has worked on, and he didn't just randomly go through here and decide what to eliminate, but he worked carefully on the vocabulary of Josephus that we know of from other sources, on different issues that appear here and what problems there are with them, and came up with the strike-throughs you see there, where if indeed one should call him a man, is a likely candidate for something Josephus did not have in his original manuscript, before a later Christian scribe probably put that in there. He was the Messiah, something Josephus definitely would not have. Why? First of all, Josephus doesn't like any of the Messiahs, and you're learning that by reading Horsley's Bandits, Prophets, and Messiahs. Josephus' perspective is this: the only people who should be ruling anything, let alone being an anointed king, Messiah, are the elite. All of the popular movements that Josephus talks about that involve someone being perceived as an anointed one or as a prophet, in Josephus' eyes, are a bunch of superstition and are the last thing in the world you should believe. So the last thing you would expect Josephus to do is actually say some average peasant was a Messiah. This is suggested as an interpolation, a later Christian modifying of this passage in Josephus in a way that makes it sound like Josephus is a Christian and makes Jesus sound even better. But what's important for us is it's likely that this was originally in Josephus in some form. This is a plausible suggestion on what should be eliminated. But what we have here is a confirmation of the execution of Jesus under Pilate, the most secure thing we know about Jesus. Other Judean and Galilean sources. Josephus was considered a Judean source because he's a Judean historian. Sure, he's writing in Greek and he's in Rome, but nonetheless, he's Judean in his background. And so other sources that we have that are Judean or Galilean include the archaeology you've been reading about in the book by Reed. Namely, we can learn a lot about the historical Jesus by learning a lot about village life in Galilee from archaeology, by studying economic life in Galilee through archaeology. So by studying archaeological evidence, we can know a lot about the context of Jesus. We can know a lot about him. We can limit and narrow the possibilities about Jesus, and we can know a lot about him by finding out, okay, what was it like to live in a village in this Galilee area in this time period? Because that limits what his life would have been like. It tells us what it is and what it isn't, to some degree, by knowing about this broader context of archaeology. What archaeology won't tell you is it will never confirm or disconfirm the Bible. What you'll have is an enriching of our understanding of the context in which the Bible was written and the context in which some of the figures described in the Bible lived by looking at archaeology. It's another example of something that's been found that's interesting, is up until recently, we did not have any non-literary evidence for Pilate as a governor in Judea. However, now, in the century, we have discovered an inscription that refers to Pilate, fragmentary inscription. What's that tell you? It doesn't tell you a whole lot about Jesus, but it just tells you, well, there's a reference to that same Pilate who was governor of Judea.
That concludes this episode. I hope you'll come again. In the meantime, you can browse my website at philipharland.com.
I like early Christianity.
The opening music of this series in the podcast is Paradise Lost by Namgyal Lamo, a Tibetan artist. You can find her on the web, and you can buy her CDs at Amazon.